joining us on IEB There. And now your host, Brad Behrens.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to IEB There, which you can also pronounce IAB There. It's the show where the name of the show is also a command and a dad joke all at the same time. I'm Brad Behrens. I'm the editor-in-chief here at the IAB. We are doing this because one of the IAB's roles is to keep the industry connected, to keep the people in the industry connected, and we are going to start doing this daily here, 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific. And our first guest at our inaugural episode is IAB's own CEO, Randy Rothenberg. Randall, welcome to IAB There.
Thank you, Brad. It's great to be here. I'm glad to be able to use my SAG-AFTRA announcer's voice again after a 25-year absence. I love the fact that I'm both side-lit and I'm wearing pants.
I'm glad that you're wearing pants, and we're all going to take that one on faith. This is the result, this show. We've been wanting to do more things like this anyway, but this particular thing is the result of coronavirus, which, and I've been racking my brains trying to think of this. I believe that this is the greatest disruption that we have experienced in our lifetimes. And I've been thinking about it, like thinking about comparisons, so that with 9/11, there was that scary mystery quality where, you know, we were waiting for the other shoe to drop. With the AIDS crisis in the 80s, you know, we didn't know how far to go. This seems bigger somehow. And I just want to know what comparisons come to your mind.
I mean, there are none. I think the closest you could come is possibly World War I in Great Britain, where giant chunks of the of society, young men, went off to war and were killed. And it had a devastating effect on the UK economy, the English economy in particular, for generations thereafter. I mean, in the US, everything else had, we either were dealing with uncertainty or we were dealing with gravity, but rarely both at the same time. You know, 9/11 affected New York City. There were fears elsewhere, but it really didn't influence other localities. The crash of 87, you know, certainly had a broad effect on the economy, but you were able to isolate the causes. The same thing with the housing bubble collapse. You were able to isolate the causes and figure out a way out in due order. I think none of us really know. In fact, none of us actually know how long this will last and what the impact will be. There are positive scenarios and there are dire scenarios. And I think the uncertainty and the gravity together are kind of what makes it a little bit difficult to wrap our arms around.
It really wasn't limited to New York. 9/11 certainly had its focal point in New York, but at the time I was working at Earthlink and I was living in Los Angeles, and we were all roused and told that we were a target because of we were a communications nexus. The other big difference, I think, between 9/11 and now, less so, I think, with the housing bubble, is that we have in this country effectively 100% penetration of the internet. Everybody who wants to be online is online. And we have extraordinary penetration of the mobile internet. So in addition to it being more mysterious as an illness, we don't know when it's going to end. We don't know how it's going to end. But also, we as a society are more connected than we've ever been before. And I wonder.
It's a double-edged sword, though. And I think we're seeing it. It's, you know, on the one hand, you have the ability to stay connected, in particular connected to family, to friends, to colleagues in direct ways, as we're doing right now, that were not possible during those previous crises. But we're also seeing the downside of these networks. And one is that false or simply inaccurate information can flow alongside the accurate information. And also there's an effect, and I'm sure there's a psychological term for this effect, where it can also amplify some of the more negative feelings. Like we can start reading ourselves into what are otherwise edge cases. You know, the 35-year-old who dies from this, well, that's an edge case. It is completely atypical, but you start reading yourself into that. You know, whereas in a society that is less connected, that only has three or four broadcast television networks, it's a little bit easier for soothing voices to calm the waters. By and large, I would say we've seen for years and years, more connectivity is better, more access to more information is better, more ability to penetrate, to get to the nut of things is better. But we also have to recognize that we don't have the soothing power of consistent unitary leadership to help give us guidance.
I also think that we've been, you know, at a sort of heightened rhetorical place as a society for the last 3 years, but in general, with the fragmentation of media, that it's harder and harder for any voice to be soothing. There's also something fascinating happening, which is, I mean, with journalism, if it bleeds, it leads. There's a phenomenon in behavioral economics called denominator neglect. And denominator neglect is where, you know, you have the numerators of a fraction that's really terrifying, and you entirely ignore the denominator. And so the worst case scenario that came out last week with the New York Times, with a wonderful piece of reporting, was a terrifying story, was that as many as 2.2 million Americans could die because of coronavirus. It's a terrifying number, but it's also a number that can be quite comforting quite quickly if you realize that we have a 327 million person population here. So the fatality rate from that dire scenario is less than 1%. Mm. Now, with different populations, I think it's going to be different. But we're dealing with a heightened rhetoric, more connectivity for better or for worse. I guess my next question would be, I want to take a break and just say, we will be looking to Twitter sort of at the tail end of this. And so if people want to tweet in questions or comments or raspberries, my Twitter handle is my name. It's at Brad Behrens, B-R-A-D-B-E-R-E-N-S. Randy?
Mine is at R2 Rothenberg. That is the letter R, the number 2, and Rothenberg. I won't spell it.
I think we know it by this time. I'd love for you to talk with the people joining us today about what IEB has done to respond to the coronavirus. We've done quite a bit, including this, but if you can walk us through what happened at the office and why.
So internally, we're shifting, as everybody else has, to a complete virtual office setup. I'd be very interested in trading facts and ideas from our member companies on how they're keeping it together virtually, because I think this is one of those sets of best practices that are evolving every day, and we can only help each other by discovering what we're all doing. What we have done very, very simply is kind of doubled down on BlueJeans and Zoom as our kind of mechanisms of choice to stay connected, although we're completely open to other mechanisms as well. We've asked each team to check in every morning, circa 10 or 10:30, conduct business over the course of the day, move our member committee and council meetings and other kinds of gatherings to virtual space on Zoom or BlueJeans. And then we, as a leadership team, as you know, Brett, check in every afternoon between 5 and 6. And I'll tell you, we've all shared this internally, but it's made for an extraordinarily efficient way of working among us. I think we've all been surprised. I certainly have been surprised at the efficiency and the effectiveness. This week is the week we're really moving whole hog to member meetings. I think we have Center of Excellence board meetings this week. So the CRO Council will be doing a pretty big meeting, I think, next week. Project REARC, at least the part of it led by the Tech Lab, a lot of the development activities and the recruitment activities from our member companies, that's taking place every day. So we're living in virtual space. In terms of everything else, it's we've really seen the role of the, we've always seen the role of the IEB as being the convening organization for various segments of the industry and for the industry as a whole to get together across those various segments. If anything, we're looking at this as requiring us to double down on that value, to act as a convening point for our members to talk to each other, to trade tips and practices and observations on everything from how are you dealing with selling in this unsettled sales environment to how are you preparing for the post-cookies evolution of the web and everything in between. So we are still obviously communicating our own research, our own thought leadership, but I think that's taking a bit of a slight second seat right now to bringing our members together to talk to each other and talk to their stakeholders.
Speaking of research, we did launch last week, and we're going to be coming out of the field this week with what we're calling a quick pulse on the impact of coronavirus on spend. Sue Hogan, who's our SVP of research, is leading that charge. Many people who are our members have already seen the request to fill out the survey. We have a ton of results in, and she's grinding through them. And we're trying to move very quickly to help capture snapshots of information for the sake of our members and the industry and the world at large.
Yes, yeah, so we sent 20,000 of those surveys out. So, and our goal, as you know, because you and Sue are leading it, our goal is to repeat this survey every couple of weeks. So we have an ongoing benchmark of market sentiment as the crisis goes on and then as it begins to ebb.
We're also talking about a bunch of other research that we'll be talking about both here and elsewhere as the time permits. Can we talk about new fronts for a minute? That's another huge endeavor. I think you're well positioned to explain what we're attempting to do and yes. And why.
So as we announced last week, I think exactly a week ago, we're moving the new fronts into a complete virtual space. We've been announcing the details as we've been bringing them online. We'll have more details again this week. We are still anticipating right now the new fronts taking place at the end of April, beginning of May. Would not be surprised if we push that a week or two. We'll be formally, we have a meeting of the New Fronts presenting partners and agency stakeholders this afternoon, I believe. And we're going to be making a set of formal decisions about the timing then. But I think it's also important to take a little bit of a step back from that, because this is probably going to be one of the permanent changes we'll be seeing in the wake of this crisis. I think it's, by the way, something that will benefit every brand, every agency, every publisher, every intermediary in the world. The new fronts and upfront season is based fundamentally on an old model of selling. In fact, I think the upfronts actually date to the 1970s. They're based on the way the auto industry's needed to be met in terms of its new model releases. That also coincided with the new television season. So we evolved this model in the media, marketing, and agency industries that had these annual live shows that then kicked off a series of live selling negotiations. And new fronts really kind of mimicked that. First, you know, broadcast upfronts, then the cable upfronts mimicked it in a slightly different way. And then the new fronts came into existence about 9-10 years ago, and we mimicked it also in a slightly different way. I think what we're gonna see now is a permanent change where there will be far more of this kind of virtual online distance presentation, not necessarily replacing the live meetings, but definitely augmenting them and deepening them. I think we'll see a longer selling season, which kind of really matches the way buying and selling and brand needs and consumer needs really are today. So it won't be limited to one specific point in time. And it'll help kind of elevate the discussions by allowing publishers in particular to go a lot deeper into their offerings, not just their new content offerings, but their product offerings, their technology offerings, and their service offerings. And I think we'll be seeing agencies and other kinds of companies following suit. So this is, I think, the beginning of a very, very, very big, momentous change in the way selling is done in the media and marketing industries.
I also think just breaking out of a bunch of live events in New York will be empowering smaller buyers or more geographically constrained people, where suddenly, instead of having to either rely entirely on their media agency or plan an expensive trip to New York, they'll be able to log in from wherever they are in order to see what's there and what might be the right fit for their company and their advertising campaign.
Oh, yeah.
So it's exciting.
The attendance at the New Fronts will now go from approximately 10,000 people live to hundreds of thousands of people live, but in virtual space, and also being able to log on to on-demand video presentations. As you know, because you've been in the meetings, I've been saying, you know, look, you know, for any given New Fronts year, maybe we'll get two or three people to come to New York from Team One in Los Angeles. Well, now the entirety of Team One will be able to tune in to the New Fronts in real time. And I think when you take that across the landscape from the Team Ones and the RPAs in Los Angeles to brands like Conagra in Chicago,
Nebraska,
Kellogg, yeah, and all that, the ability of brands and agencies and publishers to manage their own destiny and their own selling cycles according to their needs and much more fully, I think is an exciting prospect. I mean, as you and I have been saying, we've all been saying internally, it's become a cliche at this point, you should never let a good crisis go to waste. And I think this is gonna be one of the good outcomes of this good crisis.
We will find out. You mentioned the auto industry. I think that I'd like to move on to, you know, what can we predict are short-term versus long-term changes? I think that, for example, we're going into some turbulent times economically. We've already seen a huge impact on the travel business, on airlines. I think that we're likely to see, one of the things, as you know, that I formerly led the Future of Transportation Project at the Center for the Digital Future. We've already been seeing grave and interesting and fascinating changes in people's attitudes towards transportation and car buying in particular, which I know is a particular passion of yours. I'm curious what you think the sectors that are going to be sort of short-term impacted, long-term impacted. I will start and just say that I think that in-home fitness is likely to be something that is going to be a huge impact and benefit. I think that's to the detriment of gyms everywhere. I think the Peloton ad that was so notorious, turns out to have been brilliant in retrospect. I don't think pharma is going to have much trouble. I do think I'm very worried about the auto industry. I'm concerned about travel and hospitality. I think it's going to be fascinating to watch how the news business changes. We're already seeing a big uptake in people watching live television. I subscribed to my local paper here in Portland, Oregon, after several years of not subscribing, because they're doing a bang up job on covering coronavirus. And I thought, golly, you know, they need my $85. And so we resubscribed. What do you think the short-term changes and indelible long-term changes in behavior and as well and in advertising behavior might be?
I'm pleased to say I have absolutely no genius ideas here that haven't been bandied about by others. I think some of the things are obvious. And they've kind of been obvious for a long time, but then this starts kicking off. I mean, distance fitness, that's been a trend on an upswing for a while. This just makes it that much more relevant. I think for all the good that it might do Peloton, I think there'll be far more people rediscovering what I do whenever I travel, and I'm now doing at home, which is I'm doing my 45 minutes of what we used to call calisthenics, here in my bedroom. You don't need to spend a lot of money on Wi-Fi systems or exercise bikes or anything. You can pound the hell out of yourself just as well, you know, using a big rubber band. So, that clearly, I think this will obviously be, as others have said, a turning point for both the SVOD and the AVOD businesses. We used to call it OTT, over the top television, whatever you want to call it. This is going to give people a lot more of an opportunity to sample. It's also going to, I think, for that business, for the streaming video business, I think it's going to start pushing price sensitivity a lot earlier than people anticipated. So while there'll be a lot of experimentation, I also think people will be making a lot of choices here. My guess has long been that that price sensitivity in the streaming video space, consumer price sensitivity, was already approaching its limits, and that there'll be a need for some of the SVOD providers, in other words, streaming video on demand for a price subscription. More of them will be moving to advertising-based models, if not fully advertising-based, then partially advertising-based. You know, what we've seen Amazon do, for example, by acquiring IMDb and then starting the IMDb network as an ad-supported network adjacent to Amazon Prime. I think we'll be seeing more of that going on in the media space. I absolutely agree with you that this is forcing people to recall not just the value of journalism, but the value of local journalism. That's the point that you were making, yeah. I think was really astute. You want to know and you need to know what's going on in your local community. I am without question served incredibly well by the New York Times and CNN, but I need somebody to tell me what's going on right here on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, is you need to know what's going on in Portland, Oregon. So I think that will do well for the best news organizations, not just newspapers. I think radio and television stations with longstanding expertise in local journalism will also do well. And so will companies like Patch, and others that have really been pioneers in taking local journalism and bringing it into the digital space, because we need it. We should make a point, which I know we're going to be talking about in more depth tomorrow with our new president, David Cohen, and one or more special guests. I think we should also point out that the stupidity that we're now seeing of advertisers and agencies using automated systems to block the news because the news of coronavirus is so bad. So they use these automatic programmatic systems to put blockers on keywords, which means that two things: the most watched, the most read, the most consumed news of the day.
And the most important.
Most important is not getting advertising adjacent to it. So advertisers are losing the attention of very interested consumers. And secondly, at exactly the moment the world needs real, credible news more than ever, the financiers of that news are backing away. Again, we'll be talking more about this tomorrow, but I think it's a very, very important point that needs to be stressed over and over and over again.
Oh, absolutely. No, it bears repeating time and again. Let's talk about sports. I'm not a big sports guy, but I'm fascinated by the business of sports, and I'm wondering what is going to take the place of professional sports in the absence thereof. And I'm esports, and our friends at Twitch, I think, have a big opportunity. What else do you think we'll be seeing? Classic games of yesteryear replayed in real time. Do you have any guesses?
I don't know. You've just stated what I think is the most obvious outcome, is that that esports does quite well with this. But it's doing quite well without it as well.
That's true.
We had the CEO of Twitch gave one of the most powerful presentations at our annual leadership meeting
in February.
And I think it was an eye opener to a lot of folks in that audience that hadn't been paying attention to just how powerful and how large a network like Twitch has grown. And it's just part of a much, much larger phenomenon. So if you're not kind of aware of it, or if you're not a participant in it, I think that kind of smacked you between the eyes. Clearly this grows. You know, as far as the rest of it, I have a bit of a contrarian point of view. The rights fees that the networks have been paying for league broadcast rights in Major League Sports have been skyrocketing, like crazy skyrocketing. Yeah. Even though viewership has aged and actually in some sports declined. So you have this strange effect where if you kind of looked in the future, towards the future, you could kind of reach the conclusion that at some point the networks were no longer going to be able to afford these fees, and the sports leagues would then not collapse, but they'd have to adjust to different kinds of salary structures. I'm wondering whether this will force that to happen on a more accelerated basis.
Akin to what you were saying about the new fronts, which is we'll have evolutionary pressure that are accelerating things the way they were going already.
Yeah.
So, let's see.
Your friend and my friend, Jeff Cole from USC, we've been discussing this, with him
for years.
For a while. Yes. Yeah. And I'm just very interested in what that's going to look like, because so much of the linear television business has really been centered on sports for a number of years, increasingly so, despite some of the demographic trends and despite some of the competitive trends that we're seeing from esports. So I wonder whether this kind of accelerates, it's not a reckoning as much as a moderation of the economic relationships that exist between broadcast media and the sports leagues.
I also think that we may have an interesting opportunity with collegiate sports, because as colleges are moving online or taking a break entirely, how you can gather school spirit. And so I'm wondering, might we see the Oregon Ducks and USC Trojans, competing in esports together and trying to find a virtual way of that. That sort of incredibly important binding power that sports has for colleges. So I'll be curious to see if anything happens there.
Reminds me of a scene either from Office Space or from another movie. I'll remember it. I'm having a senior moment. It was not an Ed Wood movie, though. I know that.
Okay. Well, that's a relief for some of us. I want to put in a good word for Project ReArc, in which we came up earlier as we're winding down, and I'm going to check Twitter in just a moment. We have our first webinar that's sort of explaining Project ReArc, which is this Thursday, the 26th. Can you do the why this is something you can't leave to the technical people, explanation of what ReArc is and how it's embedded with the other associations?
Yeah, so we announced at our annual leadership meeting in February, the launch of what we're calling Project ReArc, which is quite literally a vast, hopefully cross-industry initiative to re-architect internet digital marketing to harmonize the value of personalization and privacy and community. We think there's no turning back from any of those three. There will be no return to business as usual. So we have to do something. And we kicked it into gear. IB and the Tech Lab have been working on the underpinnings of what we're now calling ReArc for quite a long time, really for 2 years and even longer if you look towards what the Tech Lab has been doing, especially around the acquisition of Digitrust. But then Google announced a 2-year timeframe for the phasing out of the use of third-party cookies in the Chrome browser. And that kind of put a timeframe onto it. So what we've been doing is kind of reaching out to the other associations in our neighborhood to try and bring them in as co-owners and co-managers of this project. And the way we see it is that it's so big, it has to take on multiple dimensions. The Tech Lab has already begun a lot of the technical work on what does digital marketing look like without third-party cookies. So how can you do it? How can you get the value of personalized media and personalized advertising and personalized marketing communications without inflaming or inciting privacy concerns? So that work is going on, but that needs to be complemented by a lot of other work. For example, business use cases. I think the simplest and starkest way for me to articulate this is too important a topic to be left to the engineers and product developers. We need the major consumer-facing businesses in the United States and around the world at a leadership level to understand that the foundations of how they communicate to their consumers are changing, period, full stop, changing in every way, and that they need to be able to take in this understanding and participate in Project REARC at a leadership level, and also kind of, succumbed to Project REARC, their technical people to really participate both in helping us understand all the various business use cases that need to be adapted to, and then also get involved, sleeves rolled up, with the Tech Lab in developing the new technical standards and the applications that will animate those standards and practices.
So just let me put the good word in. Please go to IAB.com, sign up for the first webinar, which is on the 26th. We'll have another one on the 31st, where this is not going to go away, and it's important, and you can learn a whole bunch about it really quickly.
Yeah, let me say one other thing on that, Brad. It was almost exactly a year ago when we started mobilizing the entire marketing and media industries to pay attention to the California Consumer Privacy Act. We'd actually started a year earlier, but you couldn't get anybody's attention because they were all suffering from GDPR fatigue. A year ago, we said, CCPA is bearing down on this industry like a freight train. Everybody needs to get mobilized. And the way we started this was with a series of webinars simply to educate the industry on CCPA. And we did 8 webinars that drew, I think, about 1,500 people total. We're doing the same thing now with Project REARC, which, if anything, is 10 times the size,
yeah,
10 times the importance of CCPA, because this is not just one piece of state legislation. This is the need to quite literally re-architect the entirety of digital marketing, from the systems to the processes to the organizations to the individuals. That's what needs to happen. And so we're really hoping that the series of webinars that we're doing will get that same kind of turnout, because we're going to need that level of participation if consumer marketing and consumer delight and consumer stimulation and consumer information are allowed to continue.
And we will continue to talk about that here and everywhere else. And again, IAB.com is the first stop, but not the only one, to find out more information about this. As we wrap up, let's talk about the softer side of things for a moment. I've been checking in on friends who live alone, right? Just picking up the phone and calling and seeing how they're doing. I think this is hardest for people who live alone. I think this is probably second hardest on people with very young children who don't understand why they can't see their friends or they can't see grandma. We're also taking time in meetings at IAB just to, before we get down to business, just to say, how's everybody doing? So far, I have one friend with coronavirus, a dear friend in Australia who's recovering quickly. What are you doing? How are you? One friend said no elastic waistbands. Even if she's working from home, she's going to wear pants that have zippers and buttons and not be pajamas, pajama blockers. You have the bow tie. What else are you up to?
Well, I'm not wearing the bow tie every day. I did it for you and I did it for our guests. And I'll continue as much as I can and as much as I remember to tie the bow tie. I do urge people to learn to tie bow ties, by the way. This is the moment to do it.
Our YouTube tutorials.
Yes, there are many of them. I am making sure to work out every morning. And I am cooking almost every evening. My girlfriend Mickey is here in the other room, and I'm cooking up a very simple storm for her, checking in. My siblings are all in the neighborhood. My 90-year-old dad is in Fort Lee, so we're checking in with each other by video chats. We've taught my dad how to do Zoom and how to do Skype. That's actually working pretty well. And the same thing, it's actually video chatting with friends. We talk about permanent changes. This is the most obvious one. That thing that used to be the scientific miracle that we only knew from very futuristic Dick Tracy comic books, you know,
the Apple,
right? Yeah. Well, it's now grown so sophisticated and so seamless that we can do it. And so I think that this may end up being the death of the telephone call, because it's so much more effective and efficient to be able to talk to people this way and see when you can actually see somebody's face. There's no mistaking the intent of the words. I think we're learning that so well now that we may be moving to a permanent video chat society.
That possible, although as they're driving and walking and things, I think also will continue to be of some service. So Randy, this is on our inaugural episode. Thank you so much. Let me just go to the credits here, which is I just want everyone to know that IAB There is a production of the Interactive Advertising Bureau. Our show today was produced by Connor Healy, Joe Ons, and John Ward. I'm Brad Behrens. I will be your host again tomorrow. Please tune in same bat time, same bat channel, 2 p.m. Eastern. Thank you for joining us at IAB There.